All right. So this was a series in which a number of different lecturers, educators, explored different ideas of contemporary art practice and the ideas of time and social practice in lots of different ways. So each one was very, very different. And I was privileged to be able to start the conversation by having the first in the Art in the Long View, thinking about On Kawara and John Cage and others. And it's my pleasure to be able to end this series with a discussion of what I'm calling time and timelessness, or just time, in fact, in the art of a number of contemporary artists, or a couple of contemporary artists, I should say. And when I initially envisioned this talk, I wanted to include Mona Hatoum, Agnes Dennis, and Richard Long. Did I hear? Oh dear. There's going to be just a little bit less Mona Hatoum than I initially envisioned. Ooh. She'll be there. She'll be there. And she's. We're beginning with her. I just realized that given the nature of time, I might not be able to give enough time to each of these. So, okay. We will give Mona some time. Okay. So, in fact, we are starting with one of Mona Hatoum's works, a work in MoMA's collection on the screen behind me. And I also want to say that I will have lots to share with you, but I want us to have a kind of discussion about some of the issues that are raised by the practices of these three artists. Given the nature of our 45 minutes together, we're just going to scratch the surface. But I want us to think about, come on in, welcome, how they fit into the current moment, how they engage in terms of their practices, what they represent, what they embody, both specifically, but perhaps in a certain way in dialogue around the issues of time and social practice as well. So we do have this work on the screen. I wish we could be up in the gallery seeing it. It's not up right now, but I'm sure we'll be installed again. It is, as I said, in MoMA's collection. And the screen sort of belies the scale. This is a work that is 13 feet in diameter. So, you know, imagine it taking up a majority of this room. This is a work created with sand in a container. And what we're seeing here, and this doesn't quite do justice to the work at all, because this is a kinetic work or sculpture by Mona Hatoum, is that it moves. So that arm is, you know, has metal teeth, and it grates the surface of the sand. And what you see here, of course, is that half is grated, and then it's swept away by the other arm of this apparatus. So it's motorized, it's kinetic, and it rotates every 12 seconds, so five times a minute. So to get this sort of sensibility, a sort of constant rotation that both creates the marks, I should go this way, as it does, and effaces them. And that's its project, this particular work by Mona Hatoum. And it's called Plus and Minus. Now, again, we're going to engage with three different artists, but I wanted to start with this work just to get us in the mindset of thinking about the question of what art is. And each of the artists that we will look at falls within a rubric we often use called conceptual art. And some people are very comfortable with this term. For others, you know, what does that mean? What does conceptual art mean? And it can mean many things, depending on the artist. But that root word, that concept, it's an idea, right? And it can be manifest in many different ways. It can be an idea that's never brought to fruition. It can be an idea that's an instruction that allows other people to perform an action or to create something, right? But it rests as this concept that can go in different ways. But the artist is the thinker, the conceptualizer. They can also be the producer or the maker, but that's up to these particular artists. And it is a form of art that we find in the post-war period up through today. And Mona Hatoum would be situated within this category, and perhaps others as well. But she comes up with an idea, she figures out how to employ it, right? And it may be that simple, but it also can be very poetic, can be very interesting, can be very challenging, and that's what conceptual art is. So just sort of throw that out as the framework. Now, the artist that I want us to look at today And I put in my title, The Nature of Time, trying to be a little witty, but the idea of artists who sometimes or always utilize materials from the earth, from the ground, from nature in different ways, whether that's in the gallery space or, you know, out in the world. And that may have some bearing on how we conceive of it, how we experience it. I mean, it certainly does, whether you're in the gallery or in the space itself. But as we talk about it today, whether it makes you, you know, how you relate to it. Okay, this is, you know, shown in the gallery. So Mona Hatoum intended for this 13 foot in diameter container to do its thing, to be turned on and to rotate. And again, we're not experiencing that you know, rotation of every 12 seconds, but I just sort of want to throw out to begin with how this might make you feel. And I don't know if people, you know, want to dive into that one or not, but what does it remind you of, sand sort of coming and going? Yeah. The passing of time, right? We have, absolutely, I'm going like this. Maybe we don't have them this big. I know in our bathroom for teeth brushing, we have the sand, you know, we turn over for the kids. But this idea of sand in the hourglass for a long period of time in tradition, that's been a symbol of time passing, sand passing through something to give a sense of time, right? Yeah, Laura. Yes and no. I mean, so that in itself is a sort of duration. And one of the things that we'll talk about with all these artists is the sort of notion of what they often call investigation, or the ideas, the sort of concepts that are set forth before an artist either gets money to make it or sees it come to fruition. So it's, you know, starting out as an idea, and often, particularly in the case of Agnes Dennis, takes a really, really long time to come to fruition, to be commissioned, etc. So that in and of itself is, you know, 10 years of time, absolutely. And then you've got to, you know, for her, it's we've got to collect the materials, you know, and activate the work itself. But I want to go from this notion of time and sand, actually, to jump more into thinking about the other artists we're going to look at here. But I want us to keep this idea of the simplicity of materials, metal, sand here, for instance, the notion of collection and where it's displayed, and sort of continue on in having us think about this. One of the other terms I'm going to throw out is the idea of land art, right? The idea of displacing things out of doors. Could be large scale, could be small scale. This is displacement, right? I mean, we don't normally find sand in MoMA or, you know, anywhere else. And so it's been collected, gathered, and set within the gallery space. It's an intervention, right? And not traditional art materials. But what if we go out of doors into the landscape and think about artists utilizing that? And we may also return to the notion of the sort of seashore and the sort of cyclical nature of time itself, right? We can put sand in an hourglass, but, you know, an ocean going back and forth, keeping a certain time or a rhythm in nature. So I have a couple of pictures here. This is Agnes Dennis, and I had the good fortune of a colleague telling me that she was going to be speaking. Agnes Dennis was going to be speaking out in the Rockaways yesterday. And I'm looking at faces, and I don't think I saw anybody here out in the geodome that we have out at the Rockaways right now as part of MoMA and PS1 as a sort of cultural center. And so she came and spoke there about her various projects. And has anybody ever heard her speak? You have. Okay. Do you want to share what she was like? She's fantastic. She's brilliant. She's an intellectual. She's sharp as a tack. She's got great ideas. And, you know, she's very, I don't know if the word is feisty, but she's very direct about herself and her art and her production, which is terrific. She doesn't suffer fools gladly. And, you know, she did an amazing job talking about, you know, her different ideas and what's come to fruition and how and why. So she actually showed this slide here, which is a compilation of photographs to do with a work called Wheatfield, A Confrontation, Battery Park Landfill is another name that it goes by. Close to home, right? And in fact, you know, in some of these photographs, if you can see them, they're pretty small, but of course there are monuments there that aren't there anymore. So it might help you locate this as Lower Manhattan. This was, you know, two blocks from Wall Street where she created Wheatfield. And I wanna ask if anybody remembers this? No? Okay. And I don't, but it was a major intervention of the time. And, you know, we're going back to 1982, but again, Dennis, Long, others, really pioneered in a lot of ways these kinds of strategies of, for instance, reclaiming the land or repurposing the land. And now a lot of contemporary artists of this very moment look back to that. Of course, Agnes Dennis is still going on. Her latest project, I should say, is to create some kind of barrier at the Rockaways. And it involves science and engineering as much as art. And she herself calls her works, you know, philosophical investigations. And I think that might be helpful for us to think about how she conceives of them, right? So again, those are photographs we see, you know, bulldozing. They're bringing in soil. As Agnes Dennis said, I always bring in my topsoil. You can't trust anybody else's topsoil. So that's one of her materials. And I mean, she's a woman who knows her projects and has experienced it all. And she doesn't want there to be any delays or problems with things that she's encountered in the past. So again, these are multiple shots of this particular project, in which she took over 2 acres of basically landfill area and, you know, dug down deep, you know, did the furrowing, planted wheat, and was able to cultivate, you know, 1,000 pounds of wheat over a more like 6 month period, I should say. So it was planted and then 4 months later it was cultivated. But again, enormous planning went into this, not 10 years, but she had ideas for it for a long time, and then enormous planning, you know, talking with, you know, gardeners, horticulturists, and, you know, making sure that this was going to count and to work, you know, getting the supplies that she needed. She did this on $10,000 with a, you know, foundation grant, and that was all. And as you can see, the wheat thrived and, you know, was threshed, and, you know, I'm not a farmer, but, you know, she was able to cultivate it. And one of the most interesting things is, and what her intention was to show the kind of misuse, in her words, of land. This was worth $4.5 billion, these 2 acres, in 1982. It's probably 20 times that. I've been told that, so I'm not guesstimating that. But so the question of how do we use land? If we put real estate on it, that has a particular value. If people are starving and need food, maybe not there, maybe elsewhere in the world, how do we treat that land and what's its value? So her idea was to go in and utilize this land to create as much wheat as she could to make this beautiful space out of it, right? And then to send the wheat around the world to be symbolically planted elsewhere. And then the rest of the wheat was fed to policemen's horses. So the idea of this sort of abundance, you know, utilized in different ways. So I know none of us experience this. I mean, we can experience it in you know, photograph form. And in fact, a lot of the art that we're talking about today exists in photographic form. This no longer exists. You know, it was done by September of 1982, right? It's only documented as an idea of sustainability and social practice and a philosophical inquiry, right? And yet those photographs are shown in art galleries, in museums, and this practice is known and sort of gave birth to, you know, further strategies and movements like this. That's a little blurry picture, but we can see the Statue of Liberty there, right? I mean, this is how close it was. It was planted facing the Statue of Liberty, so no little symbolism in this. And there's Agnes Dennis, right? What do people think? Is this art? Is this social practice? Is this a wedding of the two? Anybody care to? And you know, she calls it art. She says that everything that she does, she thinks it, she creates it, it is art. But she also says there's a scientific basis to it. and I want to sort of throw out and have us think about, you know, is something art because it's aesthetic? Can it be art because it's poetic? If it's political, is it art or not? Yeah, Debbie. Absolutely. So her consideration of, you know, she would say repurposing or reclaiming the land to provide whatever food could be, you know, grown. In this instance, wheat. That was the agenda. That was what was planted. You know, was a big part of the purpose. So it wasn't a byproduct at all. And she knew intentionally that it would be reinvested, so to speak, in that purpose. And, you know, again, it exists as documentation, it exists as a monumental earthwork or land art project that had a time. It took time to grow, it would, you know, have an ending point. Again, some people might be, you know, turned off by the fact that it has a politics, or that she had that goal in mind, or that it sort of somehow takes away from a different aesthetic, if that makes sense. Yeah. Great. So yes, I mean, she had to go with where she could find some land, but absolutely, to put something by Wall Street, particularly in the 1980s, has its own aesthetic or a statement or meaning, absolutely. And of course, positioning it there, you know, facing different, you know, ideological symbols and you know, symbols of New York. I mean, and actually there was just an article in the newspaper that maybe some of you read about Trinity Church and all of the real estate they have and sort of questions about real estate in New York and what do you use things for? These are issues that are absolutely ongoing, but Agnes Dennis will say clearly that she was one of the first to point out issues of, if not inequity, but, you know, things that we're doing to destroy the earth or, you know, and those aren't the same thing in terms of the market value and all of that, but she sees them as links that we need to produce something that's better for the earth. And that is an art in and of itself, bringing people together in collaborative effort, you know, is an art project and an art statement. Absolutely. So I'm going to have us turn from this project to one more of her projects. And actually, you know, time plays a huge role in Agnes Dennis's work. I should say, even going back further in the 1960s, she did a rice field project, which she buried. She not only grew rice, but actually buried time capsules. And here is another time capsule sort of project for her. So time itself, or even the notion of seeds, planting something in the ground for her, has import. In her other project, where she buried a time capsule in the 1960s, she buried haiku poetry, which she didn't have any copies of. And she buried questionnaires which she'd given to college students, which she felt that they would you know, be able to answer questions and that should be saved for in perpetuity. Guess what? That time capsule is going to be opened in 1,000 years. And as she often says to her audiences, you're all invited to the opening. So, you know, this idea of the play of time, right? What is time? Is it the time to grow something? Is it the time that extends beyond what we'll ever know? Is that a hopefulness or is it a cynicism, right? In this project, and you know, even in the title, right, Tree Mountain, a living time capsule, 1,000 trees, 1,000 people, 400 years. She's done, you know, gone on to do many, many projects and many since this, but here is another project where she engages in the notion of a social practice, of spreading things out over time, getting people involved with the land, and very globally, So, has anybody been to Finland lately? No? Okay, well, if you do go, then check this out. And I haven't been to this site. But, and I'm gonna switch, this is a photograph here where you can see the Finnish pine trees. But I'm gonna show you here a photograph and her drawing. So speaking of time, and you asked about Mona Hantu, and this notion of duration to create something, Agnes Dennis, in the same year that she made The Wheat Field, a confrontation, 1982, she started making drawings and conceptualizing the project that becomes Tree Mountain. And Tree Mountain is in Finland, but it was actually, the project was announced in 2005 on Earth Day in Rio de Janeiro, because it was to happen in Finland, but it was to include, and did include, people from all over the world. So those 11,000 people came from all over to this area, this sort of gravel pit in Finland, and reclaimed the land with her and planted 11,000 Finnish pine trees over this amount of space. And I've written here that the diagram is based on mathematics, because she says we should always use our intellect, and then we should wed that with nature. It's sort of the combination of the two, right? So it's a sunflower pineapple elliptical shape. And you can see in the drawing how the trees were planted, and you can see them beginning to, you know, flesh out and grow. And it will take a while longer for them to do that. But something I want to throw on top of this is another part of the condition, kind of like, you know, sending out the wheat around the world. The duration on this is not just the duration of the trees, and Agnes Dennis will be long gone before they're really all full grown. She has turned over this, it's considered a national forest, but the stewardship of this project has been given to 400 people for 400 years. So they have generations up to, she says, beyond 20 generations to care for this land. And it's up to them, and they have to be responsible. And the idea of reforesting is to, you know, get away from the deforestation, to get away from land erosion, to sort of, you know, combat that, even in one site. Right? But is it her artistic project if other people are responsible for it for 400 years? And you're like, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, I think it poses some very unique questions, right? Whether they're ecological or ethical or, you know, market, right? This is not something she can sell. She can't go to the gallery and then, you know, sell this. She can sell kind of the idea about it, she can sell the photographs about it, but now it belongs, you know, in Finland to these people, right? We can come back to this, and maybe some other things will sort of come out of our discussion of Richard Long, but let's think a little bit. Actually, I've got one Mona Hantu left. So here's Tree Mountain in winter. And here's a Mona Hantu hanging garden. So I threw one more in because I just didn't want to leave her out. And this is, in some ways, a very different condition. But I wanted to have us think about Hantu playing with this idea of time, as well as many other things, right? If you see burlap sacks growing in a museum, is time going to be the only thing you're thinking about? Right? No? Yeah? I mean, I would certainly sort of wonder a lot of things. You know, I think about growth. I think about how strange it was. I think about getting close to it and smelling it. And this is not a work in MoMA's collection, but it's called Hanging Garden. Let me throw it to you this way. Maybe it's a little hard to go back in our imagination. What if this was just a bunch of burlap sacks in a gallery? Oldenburg used a lot of burlap. If we go up to the sixth floor right now, we might see kind of a lot of burlap. But if we saw a 10-meter long sort of barricade, and I'm using that word intentionally, of burlap, right? I think certain things might come to mind. Or what if, say, it's outside of the gallery and you see a barricade of burlap? I mean, I've already mentioned the Rockaways, right? protectiveness, barricading something up, blocking something up. It's not exactly what we associate with nature, generally speaking. We could think of warfare, right? And Mona Hatoum, you know, comes from Beirut and herself has been displaced because of politics and the warfare, right? I mean, I think we see barricades and burlap or, you know, things too much now in the news, but all over the globe. But Hatoum displaces that and challenges us, right? I mean, again,
you don't see it with grass.
Do what?
You don't see it with grass.
You wouldn't see it with grass.
No.
No.
Just plain burlap.
Right.
And potting.
Absolutely. So we might, you know, be accustomed to that, or that's the everyday that we experience, right? But suddenly something is growing. No, it's not growing the first day. This is something that, you know, takes time. And so that too becomes a part of it, our experience or the experience that people have in the galleries coming upon this.
How do they
water? The museum staff help water that, yeah. I mean, it poses
a
conservation.
System.
It's not a sprinkler system. No. And this is contemporary art, not all conceptual art, but contemporary art as well, right? How do you take care of these things? Who maintains these things? Who does the condition checks? Who does the, helping cultivate something? So it, in a sense, it becomes a collaboration as well, right? It requires, you know, unless she's gonna be there, and sometimes artists are on site, right? Did anybody experience the Wolfgang Leib? You did, right? Wasn't that amazing? So I'm talking about the pollen in the atrium space.
And the milk,
absolutely. So, he works in a number of different materials, but most recently, the pollen in our atrium, filling up that space. And of course, that project is many things, right? He has to collect all that pollen. So that's part of the process, the concept. But it was so wonderful to have him here at MoMA. He was here at MoMA a lot, often like cleaning it, sweeping it. So that is an instance where an artist was really involved on a fairly regular basis, kind of maintaining their product, right? Fortunately, that one didn't grow, or that might have been a little gross. I don't want to think about what that would have grown into. So here's our friend Richard Long, and just to give us a sense of someone else's practice and in some ways going in a different direction, he started, out in England, going to art school, and his teachers really didn't understand what he was doing. He was kicked out of one art school and then went to St. Martin's, where things were a little bit better. But they still said, why don't you get a job with the forestry? Why are you not painting? Why are your sculptures walks? Because what he started doing was taking very long walks and writing down, you know, how far he'd gone and photographing his walks. And, you know, yes, these are interventions. Yes, you know, the walk creates a path wherever he goes, but that's the artwork. And a lot of people didn't really go for that at this point. Now I think many of us are more accepting of these types of interventions or understand them, or there's a context for them. You might think of, another artist, Andy Goldsworthy, who does interventions and manipulates sites, etc. Similar. This is a Richard Long, a line in Scotland. Now, like Goldsworthy, throughout the years, the decades, Long has sort of either made interventions in the road and taken pictures or rearranged things. But fairly minimally, we're not talking about the sort of displacements that we might find with artists like Michael Heiser or Robert Smithson, right? You don't need a helicopter to see it. It's not bulldozing tons of earth. And it's not on the large scale that Agnes Dennis creates, for better or for worse. Now, if I came upon this, I would wonder if it was, you know, Stonehenge or something very ancient. I don't know how you would feel, right? But he does like to traffic in that experience that is both seeming past and present. And first he began with lines, but quickly moved to circles, which is why I pointed out your lovely necklace. And so here we have one of his circles, and I think a fantastic quote that sort of emblematizes his feelings about circles, and I think perhaps how we might feel, some of us. A circle, a line, they look good, they're abstract, they're common knowledge. They belong to everyone and equally to the past, the present, and the future, right? So the circle by itself isn't necessarily contemporary, and it's not necessarily ancient. And he's sort of seizing upon that simple form. Now, if he were using other materials, you know, brick, metal, whatever, we could put him in the minimalist gallery. And maybe he is a minimalist, right? Reduced forms, sort of simple geometries. But he also brings in that sense of the earth, of the organic.
It was in the Sahara Desert.
So it was on one of his trips, and he's been all over the world, and I didn't get the exact location of where that is. But he set it up, and as far as I know, it's not there any longer. So most of his works are not, you know, if they stay, that's fine with him. He doesn't really care too much once he records it and has the experience. If it's out of doors, if it's a commission, sure. Then, you know, he is much more clear about, you know, locating it site specific and having it out of doors. But much of his work is brought into the gallery, and that's what his part of his interest is. So taking pictures and photographing things is part of his interest, or you know, creating something that can be redone in the gallery. And what does happen? So let's go from this, right? Which has its own particular feel, and it would have its own particular feel if it was not in the Sahara Desert, if it was rocks collected in some part of England where he does a lot of his work. But how is that different if we move into the gallery space? So this is South Bank Circle, 168 pieces of slate, and it says all touching. I wrote that because that's a stipulation. So he often installs his works in the galleries, but he doesn't always. If you buy one of his works for your gallery, he's not always going to be there. I don't mean because he'll pass on, but because he's not always there. You decide it's not in the right space, you have to move it or put it into storage, right? And so it is installation art and conceptual art similar in some ways to the way like Saul LeWitt's pieces are redone. Not exactly, I may be stretching it a bit, but here's a Saul LeWitt piece that's recreated after Saul LeWitt's death. As per his stipulations, we have instructions, we have a program, we have people who work this out, right? This was on our wall. Now with Saul LeWitt's work, we wash over the wall, but with Richard Long's work, we pack it up. But how are we gonna know that this is exactly the way he wanted it? We can look at photographs, but he says they all have to be touching. And has other stipulations as well. But basically, if it moves out a little bit, if it moves in a little bit, do we know that every rock, and this is not just us, this is any curator or art handler or preparator, right? Is it the same work of art? I mean, he gives them titles. I mean, I kind of want to throw out the idea that perhaps it's a little bit more like nature. You know, when you have this many pieces and they're all slightly different, and that everybody who works on this, whether it's three or four people, becomes part of an artist for that work as well. Yeah.
I think it's a work in process.
A work in process. Tell me more about that. I like that.
Well, because everybody has their own process.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sharing his process.
Right.
By allowing the gallery or the museum or any space his work, he's sharing again the process of being able to be part of the piece.
I really like that. I really
and
like that.
Feel the piece.
Yeah. So everybody gets to feel the piece. Everybody gets to be a part of that piece, and it's ongoing. It's a work in progress and a work in process. So he shares process with everybody. So everybody gets to be a part of it. Now, whether we're all artists, I don't know. I don't consider myself an artist, but you get to be a part of that process. Yeah.
And also by being the material so primitive,
mm-hmm.
it sends you back to the very primitive spaces.
Keep talking.
To to the very primitive spaces, he's done his work outside, I mean. So we come back to the primitive way we lived in the cave, because it's the same material.
Great, so it's the same material. So it isn't like a Donald Judd where it's made out of metal, and you don't have to touch these if you don't want to. They're rocks I've had at my house for a long time, which I think is a kind of funny thing too, right? I have a bowl of rocks that my husband and I have collected, and they're not fancy, they're not special, but you know, there's a certain continuity. And you said, you know, primitive or you know, ancient, like these are the materials that have been used forever, whether it was for art or tools or, you know, so there's a link there, also in his forms as well, but this notion of, you know, creating something that's an ongoing, that's a process, it's part of the earth, then it becomes, you know, perhaps part of this artwork and perhaps something that we can continue with. So that sense of time is very fluid in that. And again, don't feel like you have to touch them, but I just thought, well, we're looking at Long's work. These are not slate, but I mean, this is slate, those are not, but we might just, it just might feel a little different to us. It's not like we can walk over to a Richard Long and take one out or something, you know. Although I think it begs that sort of feeling. And I also just want you to get the sense that some of these rocks, you know, that he uses or stones are quarried, right? And often they have a sort of flat bottom, you know, so that they can be in the gallery. But other rocks he's collected on his walks. So it is an ongoing process. Maybe he collected those 10 years ago before he puts them into a space, right? And again, without being too light, who hasn't collected rocks or shells or stones, you know, or just felt that material and just had a connection to it in a certain way? And I just wanted us to sort of connect a little bit with that today and that sense of time. Right, I'm talking about conceptual art, I'm talking about artists who are living in contemporary art, and we're in 2013, but we can still feel or use those materials. And I think one of the wonderful talks in this Art in the Longview series was Jennifer Gray's talk about futurism and the speeding up of modernity. So much of the 20th century was this, you know, noise of the street and fast cars and content and making, you know, multiple perspective, and in some ways, even with conceptual art or contemporary art, we can return to a more fluid sense of time.
There's also one more thing with that.
Yeah, please.
Is that it's never the same.
It's never the same. It's never the same.
Whatever, wherever it is, it's always changing.
It's always changing. And so there's a sort of, I think, recognition, or we kind of butt heads with that and realize that the earth is always changing through time. Let's look at Agnes Dennis for a moment. You know, who knows with that forest? I mean, there's a certain amount of land, but isn't that interesting that it's sort of borderless and timeless? Who knows what trees will live and what will die, regardless of the stewardship? And it's sort of like with her, it's a different way of sort of recognizing that the earth is always changing. You know, it's not so scientific that she's saying this is going to feed the whole world or this is going to, you know, allow for trees to forest the whole world, but it's a statement that in some ways things are under our control, in some ways they're not. You know, and it's a way of sort of acknowledging that. And with Long, those works will always be different. And yet they'll always be a wonderful, you know, long piece, and different people will engage with them. Yes?
When I think about Gonzalez Torres,
yes.
Gonzalez, it's sort of a cross between the earlier one where the materials would either vanish, disappear, grow, or die.
Yes.
And then this work, it doesn't.
Uh-huh.
And his, it diminishes over time.
Yes. Absolutely, and that would have been a wonderful artist. You know, should we have 2 hours, I would love to, and I'm glad that you brought up Felix Gonzalez Torres, whose work raises so many very interesting and critical issues, but particularly the things that have to do with ephemerality or, say, the candy pieces and the taking, that it becomes, we're allowed to take it, it becomes part of us. Just to orient everybody, oftentimes at MoMA, and there are other places that display this, but one of Felix Gonzalez Torres's most famous works is a pile of candy that our curators replenish, but people are allowed to take it. So it becomes a part of you, or it becomes something, you know, an object that you have, and it does, it goes away, you know, like life itself. And this is in some ways opposite, but it also has to do in some ways with the human touch or that connection. He got all of these. He did originally think about them all together. So it's kind of interesting, you know, flip sides of that. But Felix Gonzalez Torres would be a wonderful artist to bring into this.
But I was exactly thinking the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It could be 167 pieces of slate or 169
yeah.
pieces of slate.
Okay.
Someone could take one away or someone could
right.
add one.
Right, absolutely. And the truth is, we don't know. I mean, and I say we in the royal sense of all museums or galleries, there's a little more leeway if it's out in the earth, and there's just absolutely someone could take it, and then what do? They box it up again, and it's 167 pieces. Absolutely, and that's really interesting too as a concept, as a sort of philosophical concept. It doesn't cease to exist as South Bank Circle if one piece went away, although it's missing something. You don't know where. It's not a puzzle. It's not a piece that, you know, has to fit in there. But what is the whole? Exactly. So, and you know, these are great things that you're raising and bringing up about this. I throw in this picture, and I don't even know what this work is called, but I love the variation of color and you know, how he sort of separates them out. But I want you to see how they've been installed, you know, in two different ways, and sort of wonder what it means when they do that. A number of the installations of his work have taken into account the sort of, you know, beautiful play of the architecture. I don't think this is as stunning, but between the sort of windows or glass or things that you can see, or sort of a serendipitous rhyming, if you will, between things. But that adds to the work itself, or takes away from it, or, you know, adds another layer to it as well. And I'm not saying that's different than other people's art, but I'm saying it does happen with Long's work. And there's a work that hopefully MoMA will put up on display. It's not on display right now, but that's one of our Richard Long's. We have certainly a number of his drawings as well and photographs, but we have that work there. And I wonder if it's missing a piece or two. What if somebody added to it? They could do that too, right? It sort of begs the question. Now, I've brought us to just about time, and I'm throwing up rather abruptly this slide here, but I want us to feel free to keep talking about the, for the next couple of minutes, the issues that you've been articulating so well about the other artists that are related to what we're talking about, or time and timelessness. But I also want to, for anybody who's able to stay afterwards and feels like getting their hands into some materials, I want to have us create a rongoli. Has anybody ever made a rongoli before? Okay, so in the nature of circles, and I'm actually going to have you just stand up and flash your necklace at everybody. Please do. It's fabulous. So thinking about that notion, and that's made out of zippers, she told me. That's amazing. Thinking about the notion of circles and designs and patterns and the sort of connection between the ancient and the present day. Rongolis are a traditional Indian form, originally Hindu in derivation, that were made for gathering special occasions, made on the floor. And they're sort of roundel or flower shape large designs that are made with colored materials, rice, flour, flower petals, whatever you have on hand. And so after we exit the classroom, if anybody wants to, even for a couple of minutes, join in and make a rongoli, I have legumes and shells and things like that in the rocks, and we can just add to it as we want to. But I just wanted to mention this sort of tradition, which is an incredibly beautiful and ritualistic art form, but it is also adaptable, so that you can use recyclables, you can use anything that you find to create a rongoli of any size. But it goes with that notion of sort of ancient symbolism and the sense of you know, everybody collaborating and adding to it. So they're usually manufactured by a lot of people and thought to bring good luck. So I'm gonna throw out a picture of a rongoli there. I don't think we could create that in but a few minutes. But that's what we aspire to, but I think you can see the loveliness of the craft and the sort of elaboration of design that one puts into this. This might bring to mind sand paintings or mandalas, or, you know, there are many, many traditions that sort of revere this kind of patterning and design, and there are kids sort of making this. But again, I want to sort of end our conversation here just by first thanking you all for spending your time, speaking of time and timelessness, with me today and with these works of art and these artists, and also to ask if there are other sort of questions and comments that any of this has brought up, or yeah.
Don't you think that the art has left very specific instructions how they would want that piece to be created? When he said someone could take away a piece or put back a piece. What if he said there's 100, or she said there's 169 pieces, and that's what I want put back?
Yeah.
Or the colors or the formation?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, if I would.
Yeah. So, and I'm speaking, you know, without permission to speak for Richard Long, I haven't talked to him, but I would say each artist is different, absolutely, but that I'm sure Richard Long would want the 168 pieces, so I don't want to be too light about that and say that it's okay at all, by any means. The color is already determined by the rocks, and he in his instructions, and I was trying to find a picture of some of them, they are very specific, but they also say things like, it's not just, okay, all the rocks and they need to touch. I mean, it's a specific sort of approximate diameter. But he will say things like they can all be turned in different ways, so that he doesn't say they all have to have their pointy edge up or they're this or they're that. So there is some leeway that he wants and allows for, but certainly he wouldn't say it's okay if it, you know, if. So I'm glad that you bring that up. I don't want people to walk away thinking a take a piece out of the Richard Long, unless it's you know, something that you think he set up on the side of the road. But there is some leeway in terms of. The way it's arranged, or you know, what pieces go where. And I'll take you and then I'll get back to you. Yeah.
If two people or more are sharing in and making this piece,
yeah.
Does that make it then relational art?
Good question. So we can throw out a lot of terms, right? We lose some of our isms after mm-hmm. like 1960, and they become
yeah.
these more complex terms. But absolutely, it could be a type of relational art. Mm-hmm. I mean, Richard Long's, for instance, still considers it his art, but
he does
consider it his art. He does consider each iteration. I should tell you this. He does consider each iteration, you know, a different iteration, but the same piece.
I'm sorry. So
yeah.
Does he consider it relational?
He doesn't. I don't think he uses that word
okay.
at all. But you know, if we sort of stretch that term.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be, and not in his mind,
okay.
not in his mind,
right.
Absolutely. What?
Certainly not. Now he's very specific
okay.
as far as how the work should look like
mm-hmm.
and where they should be placed. He even I have
mm-hmm.
a work of him, and
okay.
he even numbers them.
Okay.
So where to put them?
Okay. I've been doing a bunch of research and looking at places where they have placed them and allowing them to flip them up or to do different things, and I mean, I'm glad that you're adding this very helpful information for us and very accurate information for us. In what I've read, and I've seen, you know, videos on YouTube and in terms of installation and allowing other art historians and teachers and artists to come in and do this. And maybe I've been too loose in my, I mean, it sounds like I have in terms of allowing it to sound like an absolute full-on collaboration with, you know, anybody who enters into this. But he doesn't install them every single time. That's
yeah,
what I
It depends
right.
what kind of work you have. But
right.
If there are many stones, it doesn't matter so much. But if there's just a circle, so he wants the circle.
Right.
And the pieces there where he puts them.
Okay.
That's at least my experience.
Right, but they have to be reinstalled,
mm-hmm.
you know, without him on a continual basis. And if they're flipped slightly, I mean, I'm not talking about one, you know, sort of red flint circle or things like that, where say there's, you know, 20 pieces or something like that. I mean, I'm talking about the much larger ones like Norfolk flint, you know, where there are pieces and pieces and pieces. So allow me to say that at least. So but I thank you for that. Yeah.
I wonder if one of these artists, any of these artists you mentioned, related that to a ritual type of passage, you know.
A
rite of passage, I don't know.
Well, I know that Richard Long says that this is not mystical. He talks about the relationship to the past and there being circles, and the circles are forms that are imbued with a lot of associations and certainly have been, you know, important and symbolic from time immemorial. He, you know, relates that to cave painting and you know, the earliest marks and all of that. But from what I have read, he says it doesn't, you know, imply the mystical, if that makes sense. Did you want to?
And the last thing was, you spoke about responsibility with the Agatha.
Mm-hmm.
I think MoMA or any, the Tate or any museum that has to put these works of art back together have the same responsibility as those 400 people on that work.
That's
to me, it's a similar thing, I just wanted to add that. It becomes a responsibility.
I think that's a very good point. And again, in collapsing Felix Gonzalez Torres, perhaps in the 168 pieces, I don't want to make light of that in any way. But I like that you bring it up in relation the sort of 400 people, whatever they end up doing, or in Finland, or the generations after them. That's a charge, and they're actually given certificates. So in some ways, it's made sort of more concrete, but also more unpredictable. But that the curators and the preparators of any work of art, but particularly this, and not because it's organic, meaning it doesn't have any different rules, it's still a work of art, and, you know, to be stored, to be preserved, and to be reinstalled according to the wishes of the artist. And again, as I've said, there are specific rules, governing that. No one's gonna, change the color. No one's gonna, change the dimensions very, very radically. So I think that idea of responsibility is a very good one. So, anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you all. Again, if you are feeling up to getting your hands into some legumes, the rongali is right outside, and you should feel free to add to it or work on any part of its design. Thank you so much.
Thank you.